Everyone, my name is Matthew B. Lloyd, and I'm your host as we explore the world of comics before the advent of the Silver Age. And today we are going to do something a little different. Instead of looking at a single character or a single issue or something, we're going to take a look at some of the recent facsimile editions that have been coming out from Marvel and DC. And some of these are Golden Age, some of these are Silver Age, and a couple of these are even Bronze Age, but I think they're worth looking at in order to get a comparison of different things that have been coming out and available. Of course, the idea that you can get a facsimile edition of a classic comic is pretty darn cool. We've certainly talked about the Digital Comics Museum and a lot of the stuff on there that you can read. Some of it is, not really, most of it's not available elsewhere because it's never been collected in any shape or form or reprinted at all. The stuff we're going to talk about today is mostly stuff that is still, I think it's all still owned by the original publishers, and there's no way it would ever be put up on a free site like that. So some of these things might be available for digital purchase on Comixology and that sort of thing, or with the DC Universe Infinite, whatever it's called, their services where you can read comics and watch shows and all that. And of course, there's something called Marvel Unlimited. I'm not really that well versed in the digital comics realm, so, but you get the idea. You know what I'm talking about. So today I have a stack of facsimile of books that I've bought over the past few months. A couple of them may extend back a little bit more than that, just because they're still sitting there on my shelf. But I want to just take a look at these and talk about them as facsimiles, as well as some of the cool things about the original issues themselves. So let's go ahead and get started. The first one I've got in front of me is All-American Comics, number 16. The first appearance of Alan Scott, the original Green Lantern. And of course, had to let that plane go over, sorry. Of course, this came out in conjunction with the new Alan Scott Green Lantern miniseries. So, what we have here is a reproduction of this entire comic, which is cool because it's a 64-page comic. Alan Scott is maybe the only Green Lantern, only character you're going to recognize in this issue at all. But we can go ahead and take a look through it real quick. We're not going to read the whole thing. We're not even going to read Alan Scott's story because that's really not what this issue is specifically about. This episode, sorry. What we have a cover here. It's an iconic cover, his first appearance, and the image of Green Lantern here, the figure, is actually taken from a drawing from a Flash Gordon newspaper strip by Alex Raymond. The cover's by Sheldon Moldoff, and he is well known for his love of Alex Raymond, and that is something you see a lot in the Golden Age. People grabbing those Flash Gordon images and using them elsewhere. We turn it open. We have a reproduction of the inside cover with not only hawking this new character starting this issue, but an ad for Flash Comics number 7 and a candy bar ad for Baby Ruth. The story leads off with, or the issue leads off with the Green Lantern story. And it's not a long story. It's a quick, a pretty short one. Is it 10 pages? Well, maybe it's, nope, there we go. It ends so abruptly, it's hard to tell. It's 8 pages. And then next we have Hop Harrigan, who I guess would say is one of the earlier stars of All-American Comics before Alan Scott. And one thing about this issue is the paper, while it's not 100%, I guess, classic newsprint, it is much closer to that than some of the other facsimile editions we're going to look at that have a the slick paper that we see in most comics today. The this is a Hop Harrigan story. He was a an aviator in these back then, and always, I guess. He's a popular genre of character back then were aviators, anything to do with airplanes and such. And what's, I think, startling about this is the very first page, the splash panel, or just the title of the strip panel, it's a very small panel on the left side of the first page, and it jumps right into the story. We're not used to that. Even the Green Lantern story, there's a larger panel at the top announcing the Green Lantern as the title and the start of the text in the box, where this is a quick, bam, Hop Harrigan, let's get going. Almost like you might see in a newspaper strip. I don't know that he was intended as a newspaper strip initially, but it certainly has that appearance. And that story is only a few pages long. You got a Ripley's Believe It or Not insert that was part of some of these old comics at the time. And then we have two pages of Mutt and Jeff by Bud Fisher. Clearly something reprinted from the newspapers at the time. And then also a Cicero's Cat strip, a couple pages at the bottom. So two pages in its entirety by Bud Fisher and his comics from the newspapers. A little gag kind of strip called Daisy Bell is on the next page. Two strips of that. And then we have Red, White, and Blue, which was a military-themed strip or series that one was Navy, one was Air Force, one was, I guess, Marines. Is that right? Because it wouldn't have been Air Force. It would have been the Army Air Corps at the time. I think that's right, although they're all dressed like sailors in this one, so I might be wrong about that. But anyways, it's another different genre, something that you don't see much of anymore, the military-themed strips. Then after that, we have Ben Webster, and I'm not even sure what that is, but it looks like it is a newspaper strip style with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, looks like 5 Sunday pages reprinted. This is what it appears to be. But it's all thrown together like it's a single episode. So even this time in 1940, DC / All-American / National Publications is still doing a lot with their reprinting of newspaper strips as opposed to having all original material. Next up is a strip called Popsicle Pete, the typical American boy. I think we can imagine what that's about. You got a page of ads for stamps and creamsicle. A two-page text story, Traitor's Treachery. Looks like it's continuing on from previous issues, because it says part 3 at the top. Next up we have Adventures in the Unknown. This is another one of those early strips I'm not familiar with. I'll tell you this, I haven't actually read this one yet. I've of course read that Green Lantern story many times, because it's been reprinted elsewhere in, I guess most notably, the Golden Age Green Lantern Archives, which I've got and read. But I have not gone through this entire issue yet. And I thought about doing this entire issue as the episode, but I thought perhaps it would be better save for a later date, and today we'll just look at a lot of different facsimiles and see what they have to offer. Now, this is interesting. There's a house ad after this Adventures into the Unknown story, and it's says the Big Six comic magazines still lead the field, and it's got Action Comics with Superman, Adventure Comics with the Sandman, Detective Comics with Batman, All American Comics with Green Lantern, so in the issue he first appears in, Morphin Comics with the Spectre, and Flash Comics, of course, with the Flash. So it's a house ad for their line of six anthology titles at the time, and this would have been the their main line. Of course, what year is this? Batman number one has already come out. Superman number one has already come out. But I think they've only got eight titles at this point. I think I'd have to double check to see if anything else is being published, but nothing else is jumping into my head. All-Star Comics is about to come out, and there's an ad later on. I have previewed that much ahead. We get a couple more pages of Mutt and Jeff and Cicero's Cat, another Ripley's Believe It or Not page, something else about stamps on another page, must skip collecting, and then we have Scribbly by Sheldon Mayer. Of course, Sheldon Mayer is one of the early editors and editorial members at All American, National, DC, whatever we're going to call it. And we've got a nice Scribbly story here. One of his, a story about a cartoonist himself. And this would run for quite a while and be a important strip, even if it wasn't about superheroes. And of course, Ma Hunkle the Red Tornado, the original Red Tornado, will show up here in the Scribbly stories at some point. The last story in here is Gary Concord, the Ultraman, who I suppose is one of the early stars of All American before Green Lantern comes along. And he takes place in 2240 AD, so it's in the future. It's a science fiction style story with rocket ships and scientific devices of the future. Probably a little Flash Gordon inspired by the look of the characters and the setting, even though it's about the future and not another planet. And on the last page we have a house ad for All-Star Comics number one. For thrills and adventure, don't miss this first issue of All-Star Comics. And they've got a reproduction of the cover, and it's telling you what's in there. We have, from Adventure Comics, we have Sandman and the Hourman. From Morphone, we have the Spectre and Biff Bronson. And from the Flash Comics, we have the Flash and Hawkman. And from All-American Comics, we have Ultraman and Red, White, and Blue. Which reminds me, World's Finest was already being published at the time. I can say that, I think, with some certainty. But they were taking their most popular features from the other four, the other titles, anthology titles that weren't represented in Affirmation and Detective in the other book, and putting them in here, which is why we have the Flash and Hawkman. And you can see Ultraman and Red, White, and Blue are the two most popular features in All-American Comics, and so on and so forth. So that first issue of All-Star is summer of 1940, and this is July, so that thing is on sale at the same time, essentially, as this issue. And then we've got a back inside page of all kinds of giveaway things that you would see. Not giveaway. Cheaply purchased stuff. High school ring, yacht caps, learn how to swim, a midget racer, a diving submarine, jiu-jitsu, don't be bullied, a mounted police suit. Lots of different odd ads here. It'd be fun to explore all of them. And on the back, we have another ad. Now hear your own voice. You can make your own records if you sing or play an instrument. Make your own records at home. Only $3. That's amazing. $2.98. I can't imagine how well that worked. I wonder if it worked at all, or if it was a complete bust. So that's our All-American. Next up we have, though not in any kind of order, is the Flash Comics number 105, which of course was the first issue of the Barry Allen Flash series, picking up from the numbering of the original Flash comics from the 40s. So originally published in 1959, this was picking up on the numbering that had ended 10 years earlier with issue 104. And we have the Mirror Master on the cover, and of course Barry's already appeared in I think 5 issues of Showcase as a tryout, and in this issue his series launches. So we've got the entire issue reprinted, and we've got the paper that's more like a newsprint as opposed to the slick paper that we see on some of these. And once again, like the All-American comics, it has all the ads, it'll really take you back in time and put you at that in that feeling of what it's like to maybe be a kid in 1959 buying this comic. And you can also see what else is going on. There's a ad for a Superman issue in here with Titano, the Super Ape, a giant ape. Can an invulnerable gorilla with kryptonite vision defeat Superman? You'll have to go find that issue to determine if that's possible or not. And then we've got, this issue has 2 stories, of course, as many issues comics then did. The first story is called A Conqueror from 8 Million BC, and the next one is the first appearance of the Mirror Master, the Master of Mirrors. It is a nice, nice-looking reprint. The pages are really white. You can really get an idea of what it might have looked like as an original comic at the time. We're not going to read through the stories, though. We can do that some other time. Or maybe this will inspire you to go find one of these facsimile comics that we're looking at today. And there's just enough on them to make sure that you can tell it's not an original. So like we have the $3.99 price as opposed to the original 10-cent price. The very back of the comic at the bottom has a barcode with the price and the current DC logo. And they do their best not to mark up the cover, so with any kind of extra verbiage or design, so it actually looks like the original comic would have on the stands. Keeping in the Silver Age, next up I've got in front of me is My Greatest Adventure number 80, which is the first appearance of the Doom Patrol. And once again, My Greatest Adventure was originally a anthology type book of science fiction, adventure, mystery kind of stories, and so this issue is devoted entirely to the Doom Patrol, and it too has that more newsprint quality paper as opposed to slick paper. And something else as I look at it makes me think of something else to compare. Sometimes these books are, you know, that's interesting. Looking at there, these books are reprinted from either the original photostats or the original art itself, although some of that original art is gone. So it necessarily be that, but the original photostats. And other times you can tell it's a scan, a high quality scan. And I would say this entire Mighty Greatest Adventure is done from scans, and if you look at it, you can tell just by the quality of the colors on the page itself and that sort of thing. And if you look at this issue of the Flash I was just talking about, it's interesting. The Flash story itself looks like it's reprinted from the original photostats or whatever method was used at the time to print comics, which brings me up to something I'm going to talk about in a second, just a quick aside. But like the ads, like I was talking about that Superman ad, it definitely has a look of a scan, to where maybe they didn't save the originals for that, and they only saved the original of the Flash stories, and so the ads and such look different, and they are scans. Like the inside of Flash number 105 has a PSA in it, a public service announcement, the magic card, and it's about a library card, but you can look at it and tell it's a scan too, even though it's all in black and white. And the back cover of both of them definitely has that scan look to it. So that's something else to think about there. So let's take a look at the Doom Patrol issue real quick. My Greatest Adventure number 80. This came out originally in 1960. He's looking it up. 1963. And it's the origin and first appearance. So everything that's come hence about the Doom Patrol begins here. You've got the origin of all the different characters, the original four characters, Cliff Steele, Robot Man, Rita Farr, Elastawoman, or is it Elastigirl? I can't even remember now. And of course, Larry Trainor, Negative Man, and even the Chief, Niles Calder. All their original stories are in this single issue. This, of course, doesn't have the notion that he manipulated these accidents to turn them into these people with abilities and gifts despite their tragedies. But you know, it's something you can see retconned in as it's been portrayed in much more recent years. So what I wanted to talk about was, you know, it occurred to me as we look at these and other comics. Pausing just for some noise. There, you didn't even notice it that time. So what occurred to me was, I'm not really familiar with the actual process of printing comics. You know, I can, because of my art history background, I can think back to the original printing press by Gutenberg when he printed the first printing of the Bible off of a press. And I know how that was done, you know, painstakingly placing the letters in a rack so that when the press was engaged, it press the ink onto the page, much as the name of the printing press indicates. And of course, now today it's all done digitally, with pages uploaded onto a computer and printed from a computer into a printing press. And I can imagine how that works. But in this middle period of the modern age, where you can print a lot of things like comic books, like the comic books we're talking about today, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, before computers were so ubiquitous, and before they even existed, how did they get the art images printed onto a page? It's something I've never explored. I mean, I can't imagine, even in the heyday of the newspaper, there was somebody, or lots of somebodies, working in the printing press painstakingly lining up the letters for every single page of the newspaper. And they certainly weren't making engraving plates for every single comic book printed. That would have been incredibly expensive and painstaking. You know, we did some printing with wood blocks and silk screen in high school art, but never anything like this. So I guess that's something to follow up on. That sounds like something Mike Burton on his Genuine Chit Chat might have an episode about. Maybe history of the printing press, or somebody that's involved in printing and knows those kinds of answers. He has interesting things like that on his show all the time, things you don't think of, but then when you do hear about it and you go, oh, that's interesting, I need to know more about that. So there's a little aside. I guess I'm going to have to look that up at some point and figure out how that was actually all executed. But now let's turn to the next one I've got in front of me, which is Detective Comics number 58, for the first appearance of the Penguin. And this was originally published in 1941. So Penguin's been there for quite a while. Long-time Batman villain. Not as long as the Joker, but pretty long. Cover dated December of that year. The lead story, of course, is the first appearance of the Penguin. We don't get an origin, but we get the first appearance. And it's actually got a lot more depth and subtlety to it than I imagined. He's not simply played as comedic, but there is a little bit of that. But I mean, at one point towards the end of the story, he's got Batman on the train tracks and he's about to bludgeon him when the train comes by and he jumps off him, and Batman has to lay down so he doesn't get run over by the train, and he lays in between the tracks and lets the train pass over him. A pretty cool notion. But it's a quite a good story, I would say. It's more to it than one might expect. And then, much like the Green Lantern first appearance in All-Star All-American number 16, the rest of the issue is fleshed out by characters who we don't know anymore. And that's kind of what's so exciting about these facsimile editions. Of course, it's exciting to have the first appearance of Alan Scott, Green Lantern. It's really cool to have a book with the first appearance of the Penguin. But just as cool, but for different reasons, is to be able to see all the other characters in here. We went through the All-American, and lots of those were very varied genres, you know. And Detective Comics actually sticks mostly to crime and detective type stories. The next one we have is Spy, which is originally a Siegel and Schuster creation that appeared in early issues of Detective. I think it was Detective number 1 was the first appearance. Don't hold me to that. I'm not looking it up. But I believe that's correct. The main character there is named Bart Reagan. And then we've got a short little Laughs, it's called, by Henry Boltonoff, who would go on to do work for years in the comics. I believe it's the brother of Murray Boltonoff, who was one of the DC editors. It's a quick little gag. Then we have Larry Steele, A Private Eye. This one's drawn by Cliff Young. Cliff Young would do some Sandman stories later on after Simon and Kirby left the strip, I believe. And then we've got, and that's actually a pretty neat story about twin sisters that are mistaken for another. Cliff Crosby, who I think is another type of detective. He's off on a ski trip and gets tangled up in something. We got a house ad here for Adventure Comics number 69. And oddly, Prize Comics, which is not a DC title. Prize Comics number 17. It looks like Catman on the cover, but miscolored. And we talked about Catman in one of the episodes of this show early on. And that's kind of strange that you would have a non-DC ad, although I guess there could have been an error at the printers, and they put the wrong image in that slot, or there was some kind of agreement to cross promote with DC. Looking at the Adventure Comics, number 69 has a Starman on the cover and a text blurb at the top of the Shining Knight. So Shining Knight's already appeared over there. Speed Saunders, another old character from the earliest issues of Detective. He was a. He has an interesting little kind of fair play style story. And then we have a 2-page text piece, of course. Then the only other costume character in here is the Crimson Avenger, although he started out as a shadow kind of look-alike character. He turned into a costumed hero a little bit later on when it was all the rage by Jack Laty. And we've talked about some of Laty's work on the Crimson Avenger in the episode we did with Max Byrne on the Seven Soldiers of Victory. He was a founding member of that team, and that's a real short story there. It's like 4 pages, but it's not terrible, but you can see some of Laty's skill even in this short story in this issue. Got another page of house ads. We have Batman number 8, Star Spangled Comics number 4, and More Fun number 74. So More Fun number 74 is actually the second appearance of Green Arrow and Aquaman, and only the 4th appearance of Johnny Quick. And they are noted at the top of the ad for this. New features: Green Arrow, Aquaman, Johnny Quick, plus the Spectre and Dr. Fate. And you get some of the cover there, so you know what you're looking for. These kind of house ads place some context for where these different issues fit in to the overall picture of what was being published at the time, and the order of publishing, and what characters came first, and what was also going on in that same month. I mean, it'd be neat to be able to grab the issues, go back in time and grab the issues off the newsstand, or if they could print some more of these facsimiles like that. Our next story is Steve Malone, district attorney, who's got a locked room style kind of mystery he's got to solve. Maybe not quite locked room, but there are 2 dead people in a room and they got to figure it out. Another little gag strip on the next page, and then the issue is rounded out by Slam Bradley, another Siegel and Schuster character that started in Detective Comics number 1. Again, I believe that's true. I've not referenced anything or verified any of those kind of statements, just because I was doing this more as a flip through than a research paper. Now, this is a fun little story, and Slam, of course, has a long history at DC, and it comes back to be used, and he was recently used in that Gotham City Year One miniseries by Tom King and Phil Hester. Some really good art by Hester in that book. Our final page is, in fact, another house ad, and we have advertised here. This is pretty neat to see all the different comics here. Superman number 14, All-Star Comics number 8, so the first appearance of Wonder Woman, World's Finest number 4, so World's Finest might not have been out at the time we were looking at with the other book, Green Lantern number 1, so the first issue of Green Lantern with a little title, and All-Flash Quarterly number 2, the J. Garrick Flash solo book that had to be titled All Flash because Flash was already taken by his anthology title magazine. And on the back, if you're a fan of the movie A Christmas Story, you get a ad for a Red Ryder 1,000 shot cowboy carbine. So a Daisy Air Rifle ad that'll take you back to that era, won't it? That's pretty neat. Let's see. All right. Next up, we've got another Detective Comics facsimile. This time, it's issue 140, featuring the first appearance of the Riddler. And this comes from 1948. And it's a pretty decent story there for the first appearance of the Riddler. Actually get his origin, too, not simply a first appearance. And then we've got Wheaties ad with baseball player Johnny Mize from the New York Giants. Nobody knows who that is, I'm sure, except for me. A Bit of Honey ad, remember that old candy? Then we have Robot Man. Now, Robot Man first appeared in Star Spangled Comics, maybe issue one, I can't remember exactly. But eventually he migrated over here to Detective Comics, and we get a Robot Man story here. So that's one of those things that's neat. You're buying it probably because you want to read that first appearance of the Riddler, but then you get this really cool next story of Robot Man. It's only six pages, but you know, it's one of those other Golden Age characters with not a ton of history to him, but he would be used more extensively in the 80s when Roy Thomas put him in All-Star Squadron, when he had to pick some lesser-known Golden Age characters to focus on in that book, since so much of the main heroes' histories were known, and there's so much about them already told in their original tales, whereas a character like Robot Man was around in some short stories but probably didn't get a lot of nuance or in-depth exploration. Our first house ad is pretty cool here. We've got Adventure Comics 133 with Superboy on the cover. We've got Action 125 and Sensation number 82. Our next story is a Slam Bradley story. So Slam Bradley is still plugging away. That's like over 10 years for him. If this is 48, that detective number one is 37, I believe. I want to say March, but I'm not 100% sure if it's March. But I know it's 1937. We got a little text story here about going to the moon. Little ad here for an inside football book. Hey, fellows, send for this exciting new Spalding football book. And different football stars of the era will give you tips on how to play. We got Ken Strong, proper way to kick. Sammy Baugh and Don Hudson, how to pass and receive. Sid Luckman diagrams the strategy that wins games. He was a quarterback, and Sammy Baugh was a quarterback. Hudson was a receiver. And Chet Gladchuk, I have not heard of that one before, illustrates the right way to play center on defense and offense. By Spalding, may have heard of that for lots of sports equipment over the years. So we got a bazooka ad. Not Bazooka Joe, though. Instead, it's the Atom Bubble Boy. Bazooka, the Atom Bubble Boy. And like the Bazooka Joe ads, they were done as a comic strip. And rounding out the issue, we have another series you may have or may not have heard of, Boy Commandos. Originally it was a Joe Simon, Jack Kirby story or creation, and it took place originally during World War II, but when the war ended, they managed to continue on finding things to fight over even after the war. And you know, some of it really does look like Kirby and some of it does not, so it might be somebody. I didn't do any research to try to figure it out, but it really looks like Kirby in a lot of spots. Maybe Kirby laid it out, drew the ink, the splash, and some of the main characters, and maybe somebody else inked the rest, because then it starts to look a little different. But there's still a little bit of Kirby in there. Something to check out, maybe, on your own. Apparently, Boy Commandos is also appearing in World's Finest and Boy Commandos, his own, their own series at the time. After that story, we have another house ad for Scribbly. We mentioned Scribbly over in that All-American issue, and he's got his own comic now with, it's a humor comic, obviously, so as the tastes are changing and the genres are expanding, The says the first issue was an all-out sellout. So here's an ad for number two. Still by Sheldon Mayer. Neat. Then we got some more ads with shoes by Tom McCann. Ad talking about baseball and some other sports stuff, it looks like. And then we have a Charles Atlas ad, a famous Charles Atlas ad to build strength and workout. The last page, the back page, rather, I'm sorry, the back cover is a Adventures of RC and Quickie, which is an RC Cola, Royal Crown Cola ad. And I've seen these RC and Quickie ads in other Golden Age comics as well. All right, coming close to the end here, the last two things we're going to look at are a couple of Marvel reprints that are from the 70s and 80s, respectively. No, actually, that is technically 1979 on the second we're going to look at. The first one is Werewolf by Night, number 33, and it's actually the second appearance of Moon Knight. They did the first appearance a few years ago with Moon Knight, and this is the second appearance in this issue. And this is one of those facsimiles that has the slicker paper, so it's all real shiny and more magazine-like, which is what you're used to in your normal comics of today. But once again, it's a trip back into time, into the 70s. This is 1972. So they have a little disclaimer at the beginning that you'll see on some things like this, but I didn't catch any in the other ones. But this previously published content includes negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes are wrong then and are wrong now. Rather than remove this content, we want to acknowledge its harmful impact, learn from it, and spark conversation to create a more inclusive future together. So this is at the bottom of the first page. It looks like the first page was shrunk down in size a little bit so they could squeeze this into at the bottom, or they just covered up some of the art at the bottom that was just the bottom of a building, so it wouldn't have really messed with the story at all. But one of the things you might find in some of these facsimile editions that we're getting, but this is the second appearance of Moon Knight, and just like the other things, they reprint everything. You got ads, you got the bullpen bulletins that was so prevalent in all the Marvel books at the time. Stan's soapbox, a little column by Stan Lee at the time. A baseball card ad inside a Hostess cupcakes and Twinkies. I remember that. See, this is when I was a kid, so I remember things. This is like going back to the comics that I remember buying, Marvels that I bought as a kid. It's not so much a trip down an era I was unfamiliar with and what it was like to be a kid in the 40s, but these are things I remember as a kid reading. So that's kind of has its own different sense of nostalgia when it's what you actually remember, as opposed to it being a time before your time. And of course, the story isn't quite in there. There's more to come for the Werewolf by Night at the end of this issue. But this is all we're getting here with the first two appearances of Moon Knight. And interestingly, it's also telling as seeing the letters page reprinted in this. It's interesting. Sometimes you'll see people who later on become creators in the industry have their letters printed in old comics because they were readers, and that's the case here with the first one. Not a creator, but I think a lot of you will have heard of the name Dean Mullaney. He certainly had a role in comic book in comics in the, I guess, 80s and 90s, and I can't remember the exact. I think he's comic book buyer's guide. I think that's who that is. I don't remember his exact role, but I recognize the name. That's no doubt about that. So that can be kind of exciting to see those kind of things, and especially if they're in a an issue that happens to get reprinted like this. All right, we're going to finish up with ROM Space Knight number one. Apparently they're going to bring ROM back for something, and they've reprinted this first issue. Interestingly, I never got this as a kid the first time, but the splash page was really familiar. I knew I'd seen it many times, over the years. I'd seen this before, and I realized finally that it was the house ad. This first page was used as a house ad for ROM in books at the time, and that's why I was so familiar with it. It took a while to figure it out, but I did. So like I said, ROM is actually coming out in 1979, not 1980. So it's just before the 80s. So nothing from the 80s on this episode. All before the 80s, at least. But it's actually a pretty cool story. And ROM was quite a popular character for Marvel in the... as the series ran into the 80s. This is cover dated, actually, December 1979, so just on the cusp of the 80s, although, of course, created in 1979. And once again, you've got the ads that will take you back. You've got patches for your T-shirts, or is it... maybe it's iron-on transfers. Cheryl Ladd, Suzanne Summers, Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, Kiss... If you were a kid in the 70s, you certainly remember how popular those people were in the 70s, TV and music stars and such. An ad for the Saturday morning cartoons here on what network is this? Da-da-da-da-da-da. I can't even see what the network is. It's got to be... CBS, there it is. It's there. Got Mighty Mouse and Heckle and Jekyll, Bugs Bunny Roadrunner, the all-new Popeye Hour, the new Fat Albert Show, Jason of Star Command, the Tarzan and the Super Seven. So we had Tarzan, Batman, and whatever the Freedom Force was. It looks like ISIS in that picture there with the Freedom Force. I don't remember that really well. Vaguely remember that. So, that'll take you back if you're a kid remembering what it was like to watch Saturday morning cartoons. And Heroes World, Superhero Rubber Masks, Kiss Makeup Kit, NPC Model Kits, Cars. Oh, and here's the Saturday morning ABC cartoons. Lots of comic books in this one. We've got The Super Friends, Plastic Man, Mighty Man and Yuck, the world's ugliest dog. I barely remember that. Rickety Rocket, Fang Face, I remember that. Scooby and Scrappy-Doo. And then, of course, the Spider-Woman cartoon show, which was very different from any incarnation of the comic ever. But, nonetheless, it came out at the same time, I believe, her series did, so... she looked exactly the same, but her story was very different in that. If you've ever read the comic and seen the cartoon, the cartoon is actually available on Disney Plus, since they have so much of the Marvel stuff on there. That's something to check out for a real adventure into cartoon adaptations. During the 70s. And I say cartoon, guess what we talked about? We didn't really say the word animation like we do today. But nonetheless, these comics will all take you back. Something like ROM or Werewolf by Night maybe don't have the variety of things in them. But nonetheless, if you're interested in the character or just... wonder how different storytelling is in comics at the time they were published, it's a neat little adventure back and a little bit of a lesson in history and the development of the of the form of comics. Certainly, if you were to read affects all of these, you would really get an idea of how different the storytelling was throughout the years as it developed and how the art develops. And of course, you know, none of the artists that we have in the stuff from the 70s are known for being great. Unfortunately, the Werewolf by Night is not by Mike Ploog. It's by Don Perlin, so it's more of a workman-like approach. The art in the ROM is by Sal Buscema, which is very indicative of a lot of Marvel art in the 70s. Now, Bill Mantlo, the writer, did a great job on Micronauts, so he had some success with a couple different toy tie-in comics. Probably the best art of all of this is probably The Flash. Carmine Infantino, early Flash stuff, pretty darn good. And even the Bruno Premiani stuff in for the Doom Patrol is pretty darn nice. There's some good looking pages and depictions in there. Can't deny that when you look through it. It's certainly of its time as far as the style, but it's good stuff. Okay, well, thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. I know I've enjoyed reading all these and look forward to reading the couple I haven't. Some of these I've read in other places, like The Flash I've already read elsewhere, but I'm going to sit down and read it again as a single issue. The All-American, I said I hadn't read, but I've certainly skimmed through it. And, you know, there's been a lot of others that have come out over the past 5 or 6 years, I guess. They've been doing this fairly regularly. So there's just something neat about holding a classic comic in your hand, even if it is a reprint, a reproduction, a facsimile like this. Like, I know the episode I did on Fantastic Four number one, I actually didn't go to one of the reprints in Marvel Masterworks or Origins of Marvel Comics, where I probably first encountered it, but rather I used the facsimile that had come out fairly recently, and it's neat to kind of hold it in your hand, and it gives you a different sense of what it might be to experience it originally, and give you a different feeling as opposed to it's part of something else that becomes famous later on, especially in terms of that Fantastic Four issue, and rather it's something that's brand new, and it, at least in that sense, it helped me see it in a little bit different light. And I think when you have the entire issue reprinted, it really takes you back to that moment with the ads and things like that in the comics, or even the letters pages in the 70s, and if you read all the editorial stuff in those with the soapbox and, you know, bulletin bulletins, those sort of things, it really takes you back to what else is going on, looking at the house ads. And then, of course, in the issues, the anthology issues, where it's multiple characters, All-American, the two detectives we talked about today, they really expand your understanding of what comics were like at the time. And, you know, it wasn't like, you know, nobody knew Green Lantern was going to be a hit when this came out. Nobody even thought, you know, I mean, I'm sure they hoped it would be, but, you know, no one knew. And there were so many different kinds of stories in the same issue with that. You know, it's, you know, they probably didn't know what was going to be popular and what wasn't. And, of course, as time goes by, you can see that, you know, other things would become popular. Like we talked about seeing the Scribbly in All-American, and then later on we see him in his own series many years down the road. But a character that was in that All-American book, an anthology, and then later on gets his own title as humor comes into play as a more popular comic book genre in the superhero era. The first era of superheroes and comics starts to fade. Okay, well, thank you so much for listening today. I enjoyed sharing these facsimile editions with you. Hopefully you go track down some of your own and be on the lookout for what's coming out next. normally I know what's coming out next because Derek at DC Comics News always lets us know. But I don't remember what he said was next. I thought he said something, but if I think about it, I'll try to share it. All right. Thanks again. Now go read some comics.